We are now going to turn it over to Ken Carty. Thank you.
Well, we're going to talk about plurality systems this morning, and I suppose one might think, well, we don't really need to do that. We know the system, and we've lived with it. It's a system we've used in British Columbia for most of our history and most of Canadian history. But in fact, of course, if we make a recommendation, in that recommendation, we have to say why we're proposing a change. And we have to say something about what's provoking that, and that does involve some assessment of our existing system. So we need to be really clear about what's the point against which we're really comparing all these other systems, and that's the plurality system. So we're going to talk about it because it, in fact, comes in a wide range of guises. And we've had a lot of experience with it, and we know what works and what doesn't work. So let me say something about the basic principles of the system. We've been down some of this road before, but I think it's important to keep that kind of in our mind. Plurality systems are ones in which the contestants are individual candidates, individual politicians, putting their name, not some organization or party's name, on the ballot. They are systems in which candidates run in individually identifiable districts. So there's a kind of geographic dimension to the politics of most plurality systems. And the third principle that's fundamental to it is that the most popular candidate wins. That's the candidate who has the most votes, not a candidate who's met some predetermined quota, not a candidate who has more than half the votes, but the person who's won more votes than anybody else. And that means, of course, it's not possible ever to know how many votes it's going to take to win in a plurality system, because it depends on how they're spread out, how they're distributed. The English often call this system first past the post. They have a kind of addiction to horse racing, I'm told. And the analogy is to kind of a horse race. Sometimes the race is really fast. Sometimes it's really slow. But the winner wins. It doesn't matter if it's a slow race or a fast race. It's the first one past that winning pole. And that's the kind of analogy. It's the person that has the most, no matter how many they have. They might have lots of votes. They might have very few votes. And that really kind of depends on the rest of the race. So when you hear that phrase, first past the post, it really refers to these plurality systems. Well, let me say something about the key elements. Remember, we're going to talk about the three key elements of these systems, ballots and district magnitudes and formulas. Well, there is no necessary number for district magnitude. One is now the most common number, and it's the one that's most easy to work with, and most plurality systems do use one, so that each district only elects one of politicians. But it's possible to have more. Here in Vancouver, we have a city council that runs on a plurality system, and the district magnitude is 10. 10 people are elected, and what it really means is as many candidates as want run, and the 10 that have the most win, and the 11th and 12th and 13th person lose. In plurality systems, it's also not necessary that the number of votes you have corresponds to the number of people that are to be elected. So in Vancouver, we have a 10-member plurality system to elect the city council, and voters have 10 votes. You could imagine a system in which they only had 5 or 1 or 2. So the number of votes and the number of people to be elected don't necessarily correspond, and in that difference are some really quite interesting variations and possibilities in making plurality systems work. In our single-member system, of course, we operate on the principle that one person to be elected, one person votes. And it's also true that in these systems, the district magnitude doesn't need to be the same in every district. And, of course, we've alluded to some experience in British Columbia in the past where we've had 2-member districts and 3-member districts and even 6-member districts and at the same time. So there doesn't have to be a kind of equal kind of assortment of districts across the system. Well, let me say something about the ballot structure. As a second of the key elements. And typically, candidates have a list of names of candidates that are just down the ballot. And the task is pretty simple. You make a mark, usually an X, but sometimes a tick, or I suppose you could devise various kinds of marks, fill in the blanks. American ballots sometimes have that are read by machines. In fact, I think Vancouver now uses that, where there's kind of 2 black lines, and you kind of fill in the thing to make one solid line. But some very simple mark beside the name of a candidate. Nothing very sophisticated or very complex about that kind of ballot structure. It's possible to have district magnitudes greater than one, and then you get into a number of variations. The so-called block vote is a system in which there are more than one candidate to be elected, and you have as many votes as there are candidates. So that's the Vancouver City system, where there are 10 candidates, and everyone has 10 votes. You don't need to cast all those 10 votes, though some systems might say if you don't cast 10 votes, it's a spoiled ballot. You know, you can have those kinds of variations. Voters could vote for all 10 candidates, or six, depending what the number was, of the same party, or they, if there were parties, they might decide to have some votes for candidates of one party and some for candidates of another. So we've got block votes, so that's one variation. In plurality systems that use so-called cumulative voting, it's a system in which people are able to cast more than one of their votes for a particular candidate. So if you had a district magnitude of three and you had, let's say, three votes, you might be allowed to give two of them or three of them to one candidate. Or you might be able to split them among three different candidates. So in effect, you can accumulate your votes and give them all to one. And that's a way of allowing you to indicate a kind of an extra preference, an intensity of preference. And we'll see there are reasons why you might want to do that. Then there are plurality systems that use so-called limited votes. Well, those are different from block votes, and those are systems in which you have fewer votes than there are people to be elected. So let's say there are six people to be elected, and you have three votes, or four, or five, or two, or whatever. And there are reasons why you might want to limit the number of votes, because that will make that plurality system work a little bit differently. And finally, there's the single non-transferable vote, which is a special version of the limited vote. And that's a system where there are a number of candidates to be elected from the district magnitude is greater than one, and you only have one vote. And we'll talk about some of the consequences. So there's a range of variations in the kind of ballot structure. They all use the same principle, the candidates with the most votes at the end of the day win, but voters, in effect, have different kind of options in terms of the kinds and numbers of votes they might use. There's another kind of voting which is very rarely used in political assemblies, often used in really places where politics is really nasty, like universities, called approval voting. And that's a system where you can indicate approval for as many candidates as you like. And you can give a vote to everybody if you like. Or if you only approve of one of them, you can just give one vote. And basically then you kind of, and so it really identifies, these are the people that I approve of, and I won't give a vote to people I don't approve of. So that's a kind of simple yes or no, I could stand them or no, I can't stand them kind of choice. And you simply add them up. Approval voting is used in lots of organizations when there's lots of people and there's maybe not organized parties. Very rarely used in political assemblies. I can't think of one offhand. But that's a kind of variation that's out there. And each of these variations can produce really quite different results, designed to produce different kinds of results, and make plurality systems work in different kinds of ways. And we'll come back to some of those. So, while the ballot structure is in principle quite simple, you just put a simple mark beside a name, then there's variations on how many marks and what the consequences will be. The third element is the formula, and that's pretty straightforward. Votes are counted for candidates, and they're counted in the districts. They're not counted in some overall kind of way. Winners are the candidates with the greatest number, as I said, and that means that when the candidates go into the election, they have no idea what it's going to take to win. They don't know whether they're going to need half the votes or a quarter of the votes or 1,000 votes or 10 votes because it's a function of how many other candidates and how votes are split. So there's a kind of uncertainty in these kinds of systems that doesn't exist in other systems. And in fact, plurality systems are really the only ones in which the quota is not known in advance. Now, the quota might only be a percentage, but in virtually all other systems, people know what it takes to win. Plurality systems, you don't. And one might argue that, well, in fact, it's true, that votes that are cast for other than the leading candidate essentially don't contribute to electing a representative. In preferential ballots yesterday, we saw that if you vote for someone who's eliminated, your second preference then gets transferred and contributes to the subsequent count. So if your preferred candidate's eliminated, doesn't win, your preference may still contribute to deciding who does win. In a plurality system, that's not the case. If your candidate doesn't win, then your ballot, in effect, isn't part of the decision-making contribution at the end of the day in that kind of sense. I think it's we should remind ourselves that in plurality systems, mostly dominated by political parties and democracies, as we know, political parties are free to run candidates in as many districts as they like. In the last Canadian election, for instance, in 2000, the last national general election, only one party ran a candidate in every district in Canada. First time that had happened, it's actually since the 1950s. But only the Liberal Party of Canada ran a candidate in every single district, so that meant if you were a Reform supporter in some parts of Quebec, you didn't have a possibility of voting for your candidate because that party didn't run a candidate there. And the same was true for supporters of candidates of all the other political parties. In the last British Columbia election, that we remember was in 2001, all 41 BC parties, by the way, didn't run candidates, but 16 of them did, but only three of those 16 actually nominated candidates in every single district. The Liberals, the Conservatives, and the Marijuana Party all put up candidates in every district. If you were a supporter of any of the other parties, whether you got a chance to vote for them or not was a function of whether they happened to nominate some individual candidate in your district. If it had been a kind of party list system and the party's name was on the ballot, you could have voted there. You can only vote for a party if they happen to put a candidate up in your particular district. We know that's quite variable in plurality systems and becoming perhaps more variable in Canada. Plurality systems are also ones that facilitate independence running because they only have to run in a particular district. They don't have to run province-wide. If they want to run as an independent in their constituency, they can put their name on the ballot and campaign. Most other systems, perhaps the majority system excepted, make it much more difficult for independents to play a role in the system. Okay, we need, Campbell is convinced that we really need to see how these systems work, so we're going to have our little Australian friend back again, apparently. Here's the Australian rules football player, coach. And there is a kind of reminder of the first-past-the-post system means that the candidates with the most votes wins, and these kind of elections are very simple. We've seen these people before. This is the Australian suburb of somewhere in North Adelaide, I suppose. And let's see what happens here. Okay, McPhee, Jones, Bruno, Riley, and Schmidt. Oh, there's the voter going into the ballot box. Oh, voting for Bruno, this guy. Voter then folds the ballot and places it in the box. Well, we've seen that. That's how many votes there are. So there's this huge whacking pile of votes. At the end of the day, polling place is closed. And because the candidate who obtains the highest number of votes is elected, because the vote counting is simple, the results are worked out fairly quickly. Uh-oh, it sort of looks like yesterday. Who do you think won the election? Bruno? Not me. Riley? Nope, not me. Jones? Correct! Okay. Mary Jones got more votes than any of the other candidates. So Mary Jones is the new member for South Adelaide's suburbia. This seems like a fair result. After all, the team with the highest score at the end of a football game is always the winner. Apparently Australians like football games. Near football is actually kind of different than ours, but that's okay. But there's another way of looking at the situation. Suburbia has 20,000 voters. We know that 6,000 have voted for Mary Jones. That means 14,000 suburbanites did not vote for Mary. Whoop. Now they're piling them all up. Uh-oh. So here's sort of the point. Large numbers of people... we've skipped back so far. I guess this is the point that 14,000 people didn't vote for her, and none of their votes contributed to electing anybody. Okay, so that's the kind of basic difference, and we're kind of familiar with that. South Australians say the arguments for this is it's simple and it's easy to understand. The results are quickly calculated. There's little risk of error. Encourages candidates to respond well to the needs, and a majority is assured, typically. And arguments against. Total number is proportionally lower. Large parties are likely to win far more seats. Mary Jones came from the largest party. She got 100% of the seats in suburbia with only 6,000 of the 20,000 votes. So basically, that's the a system. Simple voting. Go ahead and put your X. Simple counting. Winners' total can be less than a half. Losing candidates' votes may total more than the winners. And then we saw that was the case in our friendly instance in South Australia then. That pretty clear? We all have some experience of that, and we can kind of see how large numbers of people's votes don't contribute to choosing someone. Okay, let's talk about some of the variations, because I think it's in the variations around plurality that we might well be interested. We might well decide at the end of the day that we like the kind of plurality principle. There's a lot of features to it, but we want a different kind of plurality system. So we need to know what the range of variations are. Well, let's start with the single-member plurality, first past the post. That's the one we're used to. It's a system in which large parties get more than their share of the vote. They've got lots of Mary Joneses. They have more votes than other people in their districts, and they win the districts, and we saw how that piles up. That means if large parties are getting more than their share of the seats, somebody must be getting less than their share, because there's only a same total. The pie is no bigger, and so that means that small parties, in that sense, get penalized. They get fewer seats than their share of the votes would suggest. But there is a kind of wrinkle on this, because there are some kinds of small parties that actually can do better. Think of the 1993 Canadian election, when the party that had the fourth largest number of votes in the country became the official opposition. You know, in 1993, the Liberals got the most votes, the Conservatives got the second largest number of votes, the Reform Party got the third largest number of votes in Canada, the Bloc Québécois got the fourth largest number of votes, and the New Democrats got the fifth largest number of votes across the country. But who had the second largest number of seats in the House of Commons? The Bloc Québécois. Why? Because even though they only had about 10% of the whole country, they had them all squished into 75 districts. So they actually won quite a lot of those districts. Over the whole country, they didn't do so well, but by concentrating their vote in individual districts, they were able to win lots of seats. And so in a plurality system, small parties that are quite geographically concentrated, remember this is a system based on geography, individual constituencies, can get bonuses. Parties that same size that have support all the way across the country get penalized. There was a version of that in the difference between Reform and the Conservatives. They got almost the same number of votes. Conservatives got two seats, Jean Charest and Elsie Wayne in St. John. And Reform got 50-some seats with the same number of votes. That's because Reform's votes, of course, were concentrated in two provinces in Western Canada, Alberta and British Columbia, for the most part, where they won lots of seats. The Conservatives, same number of votes, were spread out across 300 seats, and they ended up in second or third place everywhere. Reform either ended up first or nowhere. That was the same with the Bloc. So some small parties can do well. Other small parties with the same number of votes can be severely penalized. So it's not quite true to say that the largest party almost always gets a bonus, though in wrong winner cases, so-called, that's not the case. But small parties, how well they'll do depends on whether they're concentrated. And so if you're a kind of small opposition party, you have an incentive to kind of concentrate your focus more narrowly rather than trying to appeal more broadly. Artificial majorities are common. We talked about that a week or so ago. Only once in the last 50 years in British Columbia has a party won a majority of the votes, so all of them win a majority of seats, because that's the bonus that the largest parties get. And we know that the support that local representatives get is highly variable, because what's true at the provincial level is also true at the individual constituency level. For instance, in 2001, the last provincial election in British Columbia, a quarter of the MLAs who were elected did not have a majority of support in their district. That means three quarters did, which is actually a remarkably high number. The election before, though, was quite different. In 1996, two-thirds of those people elected in districts around British Columbia didn't have the support of a majority of their constituents. So it went from two-thirds to a quarter. Enormous kind of variations. And some members might have lots of support in their local area. Some members may have very little support in their local area. They all have the same kind of role and status and legitimacy in the system and the same kind of influence in one vote in the legislature. So that's what single-member districts with one vote kind of work like. Well, what about block votes? Remember, block votes are cases where there is more than one member to be elected from the district, and voters have as many votes as there are candidates to be elected. It basically works like the single-member plurality system with a couple of interesting wrinkles. First of all, when you actually increase the number of candidates to be elected, the district magnitude, you actually can reduce the proportionality. In every other kind of electoral system, when you increase the number of candidates being elected, you increase the chances of the results being proportional. Seats equal to votes. When they have a block voting system, that actually decreases. That relationship reverses because of the way that the mathematics and mechanics work out. Voters can divide their support between candidates of different parties so that if you have a two-member district and you have two votes, you might decide, well, I'll give one vote to the Liberals and one vote to the New Democrats. In practice, that rarely happens. In practice, most people tend to vote for the candidates of the same party, and that's one of the things that, in fact, exaggerates the seat bonuses. The last two elections in British Columbia, where we had multi-member districts, in 1983, there were seven of them, and all seven elected candidates from the same party. So voters weren't using the opportunity to split their ballot. They, in fact, were returning candidates of the same party in every case. So there were 14 people elected. And you know, had they been divided into 14 separate districts, there might have been more variation from district to district. By concentrating them, you reduce that propensity and you, in fact, exaggerate the bonuses that the big parties get. In 1986, the last election, we had 17 districts in British Columbia returning more than one member. They were all two-member districts. And all but one elected MLAs from the same party. Vancouver Point Grey elected a SOCRED and a New Democrat, Darlene Marzari and Kim Campbell, but every other district in the province elected candidates of the same party. So people weren't taking the advantage, and it's that kind of party voting where you can put it two or three in one constituency that reverses the proportionality ratio. The cumulative vote. Well, this is where voters can, in fact, give more than one of their votes to a similar candidate. And in effect, what that does is allow voters to indicate a kind of strong preference, that they have a strong preference for a particular candidate or a particular political party. These systems are, in fact, increasingly being used in a number of American cities in municipal politics, because one of the things that's said about them is that they're kind of proportional, they're semi-proportional, and that minority groups are often able to accumulate their votes and make sure that at least one of their representatives gets elected. So in American cities, there might be three or four member districts, and some of the minorities that exist in America, there might be 10 or 15% in the city. And they'll say, well, look, the people in those communities put all their votes behind one candidate, and it means they at least get one candidate elected to the council. So it's a way in which some smaller minorities may be able to get some representation, not proportional, but by accumulating their votes, saying, look, if we spread our votes out, we won't get anybody elected. But if we really concentrate the limited number of votes we have, we can kind of at least get something. And so cumulative votes have been, are I think, increasingly popular and increasingly talked about in situations that are divided like this with very visible, highly politicized minorities. And we're seeing some of that. Limited votes. Trying to think of an example the other day. I think the Spanish Senate is one for those aficionados of the Spanish Senate. Use a limited vote. And that's where there are a number of candidates to be elected and you have slightly fewer votes than there are candidates. And that means that the share of the vote you need to get elected gets reduced. You can kind of work that out in the mathematics. What tends to happen is that in the large parties will nominate three or four candidates. Their supporters have to decide which of those candidates to share, and that tends to kind of split up the party vote. So what often happens is in the large parties, candidates are often running against their running mates. If a party nominates three candidates, voters only have two votes. You know, these three candidates are trying to get party A's voters to vote for them. There's three of them looking for two votes each, and they're bound to be in competition. What it allows, of course, is for small parties to focus their votes on one candidate, by reducing the quota, get some of them elected. So the share of the votes that are necessary to get elected in limited vote systems goes down a little bit as the district magnitude goes up. So in the Spanish Senate now, they have four-member districts, and people have three votes. And the quota is the you can guarantee you can get somebody elected with about 40% of the vote, or just over 40% of the vote. So there's it's just a way of trying to make it a little bit easier for some of the smaller parties to get at least some kind of representation. But it's a kind of cumbersome system and not used real widely, but it's an option. The extreme version of the limited vote is where you actually only have one vote and there are several candidates to be elected. This is a system used in Japan for most of the period after World War II up till their electoral system reforms of almost a decade ago now, used in Korea, Taiwan. This is a system where the districts will return four or five members. People only have one vote. That means the four or five candidates who get the most votes get elected. And in practice, these systems tend to work rather more like proportional systems in that the vote seat share balance looks more like proportional systems than it does like plurality systems. But it also has the mechanics of working it out tends to produce systems that are likely to produce majority governments. So there's a kind of funny balance there. What it does, though, is it produces enormous competition between running mates of the same party. And that's one of the things that's alleged to have led to a good deal of the factionalism in Japanese political parties. Because a big party will nominate three or four candidates, if there are three or four to get elected, voters only have one vote. And so the candidates of the party are all competing against one another for their party's supporters' one vote. And that leads to a fair amount of internal competition. What it means, of course, is that voters get to decide who the members elected are. It tends to make those kind of candidates very locally focused. In Japan, that really went to the extreme, and a good deal of money was spent in all this kind of activity. But in a four-member district with only one vote, candidates could be pretty sure they could get elected if they could get 20% of the vote. So it did reduce the quota and stimulated a certain amount of proportionality. Well, let me say a little bit about ballot design. Some people have asked, in plurality systems, particularly when there are a number of people to be elected, is alphabetical voting a problem? You know, if you have 30 names on a list, and you certainly have more than 30 names, say, on the list in Vancouver, when you've got 10 people to be elected, and at least two parties, and three parties, and lots of independents, do people just start at the top and go A, B, C, D, and tick off the first 10? There's not much evidence of that. That in many systems that alphabetical voting really is a problem, mostly because, of course, in these kind of systems, they've moved to putting parties' names on ballot papers. And to give you some kind of example, I just made up this kind of chart. I don't know whether you can read it very easily here on the screen. You may have it on the list. Basically, these are the same list of 16 candidates. Let's assume this is a five-member district, and initially, you're going to it's a block vote system, so you've got five votes. Well, the ballot paper on the left simply just lists 16 names in alphabetical order. I actually went through the members' directory and just picked out the names. We don't actually have anybody whose first name starts with O, I discovered. But and you could imagine if you had five votes that were presented with that list, you'd have to work a little bit at kind of finding your preferred candidate, and the list might actually get longer. You could see that if you just simply manipulate the paper a little bit and go to the middle case, there we've decided that there are three political parties, Campbell's Red, Blue, and Gold. And by putting the party label on the list, you facilitate the task of the voter really quite considerably, partly by sending them a signal. So if someone really wanted to vote for the blue candidates, you could say, oh, okay, Brad's a blue, and Dan's a blue, and Edith's a blue, and Ian's a blue, and Leanne's a blue, and put ticks beside those names. But if you're going to go into this kind of system, you might actually go to the version on the right, where, in fact, you just put list of candidates by party. And in party list systems, then you can just put a box beside the party's names, red, blue, and gold, and just say, just tick off that, and you can have all five in kind of one tick. So kind of ballot designs can produce different kinds of things. If you had to choose only three candidates for a five-member district, it was a limited vote, then, of course, you'd have to choose amongst them because you'd have to go into one of those parties' lists or the total list and only tick three. So if you were in a limited vote and only had three candidates, or a single transferable vote and you only had one, if we had a single non-transferable vote, you would have, and you had the ballot on the right, you'd only have one ballot. So you might decide, well, I have to decide among the parties and then within the parties, or you might want to decide by candidates. But the tasks are somewhat different. And there's a good deal of variation in the kinds of signals that ballots can send to voters to make it easier or make it less transparent in terms of what's going on, to emphasize the political parties or to emphasize the candidates. You can imagine there are enormous numbers of variations in these kind of plurality systems. The system on the kind of thing on the right is designed to stimulate party voting, kind of make voters think that way. In New Brunswick, when the government, for a long time, the parties used to produce the ballots. Then the government said, well, we'll produce the ballots. And the government wrote the law so that there would be a ballot sort of like the one on the right. And the only proviso was that the government candidates would all be at the top. The opposition candidates would be at the bottom. Whether it got them anything or not, one doesn't know. But you can see that, you know, there's some kind of hope that you can kind of send signals. Oh, these are better, these are worse, in this kind of ballot design sort of stuff. Well, let me say something about the evaluation of these kinds of systems. Remember, we said that we had five criteria around governing and four criteria around voters, and Campbell talked about them. Scores. I assume most of you are beginning to kind of make little score sheets for yourselves around these criteria. I simply adopted kind of G for good and P for poor and M for I can't make up my mind. In the middle. First criteria, remember, was about stable government. And by stable government, we often mean long-lasting government, governments that are well-established and can carry on without worrying about being defeated. Well, we know that plurality systems are amongst the best at producing stable governments because they produce majority governments. Very often, they're artificial majorities, that is, majorities that exist even though the party doesn't have a majority of the votes. And we know that one-party majority governments typically last longer than coalitions, typically last longer than minorities. That kind of a stability, capacity to plan, to organize, and to really decide when the elections are going to be on their own rather than a parliament deciding it. So that if guaranteeing a stable, long-lasting, predictable majority government is an important criteria, then you would want to rate this system, I think, relatively highly. Electoral accountability. Well, one of the things we know about these systems is they tend to encourage two-party competition. We talked about how the system was, in fact, had convinced the Alliance and the Conservatives that they had to kind of come together if they were to have any chance against the Liberals, because the largest parties do well and small parties are penalized. So there is a kind of propensity to stimulating two-party competition. A two-party competition, or to the extent we move towards it, stimulates a competition of government versus opposition. So that at election time, elections increasingly become choices about governments. Do you want the people who are now in to stay in, or do you want them out? At the last election, it was pretty clear if you wanted the NDP to stay, you could vote for them. If you were tired of them and wanted them out, you knew what you had to do. You had to vote for the Liberals. didn't have any other kind of realistic choices, as most people saw it, because the system tended to throw up these two basic alternatives. But by doing so, it gave a very clear signal what to do if you wanted to change the government or what to do if you wanted to keep it, and allowed voters to, in fact, turn the election into not a choice of just their representatives or their constituencies, but a choice of which governments they wanted to come out of that election process. It also, it's a system which allows voters to support or oppose individual local candidates. If you don't like your local candidate, you know what to do. You can vote them out. You can vote for someone else. In party list systems, we'll see that's not always possible. The party might produce a list. You can vote for the party or not, and they may end up deciding which candidates get elected or don't get elected. So that if you want a system in which that facilitates holding individual politicians accountable, this is a system that does it, because voters can get at the candidates in a much more direct, clear, simple way than in a lot of other systems. And of course, it provides a system for local representation. That's how it's designed. It's designed around the principle of local representation in geographic terms. So it's a kind of electoral accountability of two sorts, one of the government, but also of the individual politicians at the local level. It's a system, of course, that often requires and facilitates the by-election process. Because in most plurality systems, if the member dies, gets run over by a bus, gets appointed to the Senate, all kinds of awful things, then there's no representative. And there has to be a by-election called. In systems that use party lists, very often if the member dies or gets appointed to the Senate or some other unimaginable thing, the party just assigns the next person on the list. There's no election. It's kind of automatically done. The French actually use a kind of combination where you actually elect a member and a substitute in case the member goes, so you don't have to have another election. So it's a system which requires by-elections, or at least provides for by-elections in a way that lots of other systems don't necessarily do. Okay, so I think on electoral accountability, one traditionally would score this system as being quite good at that. It's one of its virtues. Parliamentary check on government, we said, was a third important criteria. And on balance, we would probably say that this system does rather poorly. It does poorly because of one of its other virtues. So one of its virtues turns out to be a vice now when we think about it in these terms. And that is, it produces one-party majority governments. And one-party majority governments can't be held to task by an opposition that's smaller and that can't vote them out. And so the government can pretty well do what it wants, can pass whatever laws it wants. If there's any check on the government, it's within its own caucus, within its own backbenchers, typically in private. So on the one hand, a strength that has majority government can count on doing what it has to do, take tough decisions. On the other hand, it means that the parliament, the legislature, can't check it, hold it to task, dismiss it if it does something outrageous. In minority situations, if the parliament thinks the government has behaved outrageously, it can just vote it out. Can't do it. So this is a system which doesn't provide much of that to the extent that it produces majorities, which is one of the things we want it for. In terms of the role of members, I just put a little equal sign up there, because it's a system in which all members have a kind of equal status. We'll see that in other kinds of systems, not all but others, members may have different constituencies, represent different kinds of groups, get elected in different ways, be threatened by elections or not in different kinds of ways. In a plurality system, all members represent individual constituencies. As the Prime Minister, the former Prime Minister, want to say, he was only the poor member from Shawinigan who had to help all his constituents get government grants, just like any other member. But it was true. I mean, he was their member. He was the only one they could go to. So there is, in that sense, a kind of common responsibility, common equal standing that all members have as members. And in some other systems, that's not quite so true. Okay, fair representation of political parties. Well, I think that on balance, this is a kind of an evaluation in which we'd say the system does rather poorly. It does poorly because, of course, it creates these majorities, because it distorts the relationship between the votes that parties get and the seats that they get. I mean, if you can get a big majority of seats in Parliament with only 40% of the vote, as the Liberals have in the last three elections. Well, actually, they didn't get a big majority in 97, but they got majorities in all those elections. In the three elections Chrétien won, that he had majority governments, he never got more than about 40% of the vote of Canadians. And if André was right, if only, 60% of people were voting, 60% times 40, maybe a quarter of Canadians were voting for these governments that then had a majority status. So the system is particularly bad on that, and on any criteria, we'd rank it poorly, I think. It's also a system we know, because remember we talked a week or so ago about how some systems differentially represent or provide for the election of groups that have been traditionally underrepresented in Parliament. In most legislatures, women, visible minorities, other groups that have traditionally not been part of the political elites seem to be getting elected in larger numbers in other kinds of systems. Plurality systems, they do worse in. They're making the least advances. So that in those representational terms as well, the system appears to rank poorly. Again, by comparison to others. And in fact, you can see that there's trade-offs, eh? The first two, the things that we thought were good, are part of the reason why we think the things are bad on the second two criteria. The fifth criteria we talked about a little bit on that first day, on that first Sunday, was does it facilitate the building of democratic, effective political parties? Or what does it do to political parties? Maybe a better question. Well, we know that these systems tend to produce smaller numbers of political parties. Plurality systems have fewer political parties, partly because they discourage small parties by not giving them any seats, not letting them win. And so there's not much incentive to build parties and to campaign if you don't have much chance of winning. There's incentives for small parties maybe to get together and join bigger ones and to produce larger, less non-ideological, vote vacuuming, catch-all kinds of political parties. Political bargaining in those kinds of situations takes place within political parties rather than between them. And so the kind of the political trade-offs of the political party world take place in the back rooms of political parties rather than in the deals made between leaders and members of different parties. And it's a system which tends to produce more decentralized political parties in terms of their internal organizational life, because the parties exist to win votes and to contest elections. Elections are being contested down in individual constituencies. So it's often more efficient to have more decentralized organizations to get closer to the ground where you're fighting those battles. Other systems that are not built around local decentralized constituencies don't provide the same kind of incentive. So by and large, these are systems that have fewer political parties, they're less ideological, or they're less interest-based, or they're more general, more catch-all, more vote vacuuming kind of things, probably more kind of decentralized kinds of organizations of a different style. I'm not sure whether you call that good or poor. I mean, that's a kind of different judgment, so I opted out. Voter choice. We had a series of criteria that we want to think about elections in terms of what they do for voters, for citizens. Well, what do they provide much in the way of choice? Well, I think that by comparison, and again, these judgments are all comparative, I would have thought they'd rather do poorly. You get to put an X beside one or two people's names. That's not a very sophisticated kind of choice. You can't make preferential decisions. I like this person better than that, but that one better than the third. You can't have your preferences count in that kind of way. You can't distinguish between parties and candidates. Say, well, I like that candidate, but I prefer that party, and somehow I want to indicate that. So it's a very simple, kind of crude voter mechanism. Identifiable representation. Well, for the voters, it's a system designed to make it pretty clear who their representative is and to tie that representative to the voter. At the end of the day, voters and constituencies know that the politician from their district represents them and will have to come back to them at the next election, and that they can go to them. And this is particularly true in single-member districts. But if you have systems where people vote for just one party across the whole country, it's not clear that any given individual represents you or that you have any political connection to them. And so party list systems don't really provide for any of that kind of identifiable representation, a connection between voters and politicians. So on this score, we would probably rank this system as fairly good. Encouragement to participate. This is a tough one, so I opted out of making a hard decision. Put a big yellow M for can't make up my mind or middling or something. Because on the one hand, it does provide for kind of clear, simple choices, simple counting. People can see what's going on. They can understand who wins and why they won. And there's lots of party list systems when it's pretty hard to kind of figure out who got those last seats, and because the mathematics are complicated and the processes are complex. So this is simple, transparent, very understandable. So one might think that that ought to encourage people to participate. But on the other hand, we know that people who live in areas where one party has a huge advantage maybe not have much incentive to participate. Andre said he thought the differences were rather small. But, you know, if you're in some parts of Alberta and you're a very keen New Democrat, you might well say, well, what's the point? You know, there's not much chance here. And that's kind of reflected a little bit in the turnout rate. So Andre said that plurality systems tend to be up to 5 points lower turnout levels. Something's going on in the world in the last decade that's changing all that very quickly, because turnout rates are falling more than that difference is. I mean, they've fallen by 10 points in the last decade or so, virtually all across the established democratic world. And that 10-point drop is bigger than the drop between systems. But still, it does seem to be that turnouts are a little bit lower in plurality systems. So that would suggest that in some ways they must discourage participation. So on the one hand, it's clear, simple, easy to get in and to make decisions. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to be happening. So I guess it depends how you want to judge that. Final criteria, I suppose, was the equality of the vote. Do all votes count equally? Well, it can only do that if all districts are of equal size, and it's extremely difficult to get all districts of equal size in plurality systems, partly because people are moving at enormous rates. It's estimated that about 18% of Canadians move every year. Over the life of a parliament, almost half Canadians change their addresses, many of them within districts, but still enormous mobility. And when we live in a society like ours, that kind of mobility makes it very difficult to maintain equally sized districts. We have to change the districts at least every decade to get them even remotely close. And that, of course, means a fair amount of internal organizational turmoil and change for political parties and for candidates. Sheila Copps is in one such battle in Hamilton now that's been in the press a lot, because that part of Ontario has all been changed. They had to change all the districts. So maintaining equally sized districts, which is necessary to maintain equal vote parity, is extremely difficult. We know, of course, that the challenges of representing some districts are much different than challenges of representing other districts. People who represent cities will say it's way harder. People who represent rural areas will say it's real harder. And both of them are right, and they're harder in much different kinds of ways and have different kinds of challenges. But we also know, remember, suburban South Adelaide or North Adelaide or where Mary Jones got 6,000 of the 20,000 votes, 14,000 didn't count. And one might say, well, that's not an equal situation, which 6,000 people's votes contributed to electing someone, 14,000 people's votes didn't contribute because they happened not to vote for the same person. And that there's some kind of inequality in that. So many people would argue that equality of the vote system doesn't do quite so well. So that's kind of my reading in a general way. Some strengths, some weaknesses of these kind of systems. In effect, there's a series of trade-offs involved in general terms in these kinds of systems. And, of course, you can manipulate things like ballot structures and formula a little bit to tweak those things. Single transferable vote tweaks it a little bit. The limited vote tweaks it a little bit another way. But basically, these are kind of general, I suppose, evaluations of the plurality system. So in summary, I guess we can think about their strengths and their weaknesses. In terms of strengths, produces majority governments. Produces good local representation. Limits minor parties. Others might think that's a weakness, but it may keep extremist parties or the rhinoceros or whatever out of politics. The Millionaires Party we'll probably never see in the British Columbia legislature. It produced a system in which governments and members are easily accountable. It produced a system that's easy to use, easy to understand. It produced a system that everybody knows how it works. We've used it. We use it for other kinds of elections in this country, for our parliament in Ottawa, for most of our local districts. So it has a kind of integration with other parts of the political world. And maybe some people would think it would be a good thing to use the same voting system for parliament and local council and provincial legislature. Weaknesses. Well, it allows governments to dominate parliament. Doesn't provide for much of a clear seat-vote relationship. Minority interests are shut out. That's the other side of keeping small parties out. From this perspective, it's a weakness. It provides these simple either-or choices. We're great kind of choices between parties that many people think kind of at the end of the day say one thing but kind of look like one another, because they're, after all, there's only two parties trying to move to the center to take votes from each other. They have to kind of come to look like each other a little bit. Votes don't count equally. Almost impossible to make that so without a very heavy-handed, constant redrawing of electoral maps. And, of course, many votes don't contribute to electing anybody. That's not the case in other kinds of systems. We saw in the majority system how if you don't get your first choice, your second choice might contribute to making a difference. And voter turnout is slightly lower. So those all, I would have thought, on balance, probably add up to the downside or the weaknesses. Well, what would a plurality system look like in British Columbia? This is the easiest question to answer because we know. When we talk about the other systems, we have to kind of make kind of educated guesses. Think about the last 50 years. Keeping the kind of plurality system we have will probably contribute to keeping pretty much the same kind of politics. Something to think about. If you like it, it's good. If you don't like it, why didn't you like it? Well, what is it about the kind of politics of the last 50 years that you're not so sure was so good? And because if you can identify that, then maybe you can look for that in one of the strengths of some other system. If, in fact, you like the plurality system, think about why you like it. And are there ways that maybe we could tweak it so you'd like it even more? One thing, when we come to make a final set of recommendations, we're going to have to say something about the plurality system. There might be other systems we won't have to talk about if we decide we don't like them or you don't like anything about them. The plurality system, we're going to have to say something about in our report to the people of British Columbia about what we think is good about it, what we think is not so good about it. And if we're going to recommend a change, we're going to have to identify pretty clearly what the features and elements of this system are that we think really are such a problem that we're going to need to recommend change. So some kind of careful thinking through those strengths and weaknesses, how you assess them, and the kind of conclusion you come to is a really critical early part of where we're moving. So before we break for coffee, I should say, are there questions? We're running a little bit over time. Yes.
It's not so much a question as it is a comment. I'd just like to suggest that maybe we stop using the word stable when we're talking about this system and talk about the word that you've used, which is long-lasting, because for me, when I think of the word stable, I tend to think of stable of mind, and I don't necessarily see that in the legislature right now. What I see more is like a stable of horses or mules. So...
I think it's a really good and fair point. Political scientists tend to talk a lot about stability in terms of long-lasting. And a lot of that grew out of the literature that looked at places like Italy, where governments changed more than once a year for 50 years. Governments would fall, and then they get reconstructed. And one of the interesting things about the Italian system was, of course, the same party ended up in power. Government would get defeated, a new government would form, and be kind of the same old guys. They would revolve in chairs. And government defeats in Italy were kind of like cabinet shuffles in Canada. in interesting kind of ways. But that's right. Stability has come to kind of mean in a lot of the political science literature endurance, long-lasting. And there has been a kind of bias that governments that could last a little bit longer were better because they could plan, take hard decisions, et cetera, that they didn't worry about being defeated tomorrow. And that somehow that was a good thing. I guess it was a good thing if you were in office, and it wasn't a good thing if you weren't. But that's a fair point, and I've fallen in the trap of using that kind of language. Wilf, did you have a...
Yes, thank you. A couple comments. By-elections you mentioned as possibly a negative. I see by-elections as a best performance rating the government could have.
I didn't mean it as a negative. I meant that plurality systems do require by-elections.
Yes.
Other kinds of systems often don't have by-elections.
But that may be a positive.
No, yes. I mean, yeah. Yes.
Okay. And the other thing, you mentioned that in other systems you need a centralized political party, or they tend to encourage centralized parties. I think one of our biggest problems is too much centralization of authority and of power. And so decentralized political parties I see as a desirable thing. And I'm not saying we should keep our present system. I also have a question. Can a quota in a plurality system be established that is other than 50% as in a majoritarian system so that you don't have somebody elected with 20% of the vote?
No, plurality system really means the guy or gal with the most votes wins. If there's only two candidates, it's going to be 50%.
Yes.
But if there's 11 candidates, it might be 10% or 8%.
But why couldn't a threshold be incorporated?
Well, then what would you do if somebody didn't meet the threshold? It would be a kind of, then you'd have to have either a runoff or a second ballot.
Or the alternative vote.
Well, that's essentially, the alternative vote is really a majority system. I guess you could have an alternative vote with a lower threshold.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay. I don't know if it's been tried, but that's an interesting idea. But yes, there's no reason why you couldn't. You could say that there's a threshold of 40%, if you don't, but we'll have to have a preferential alternative vote ballot to provide for that, or a runoff. Could be done. Yeah.
Julie.
Just a quick question relative to the plurality system presently used in Canada. Could you talk to us a bit about the place of coalition governments or coalitions of parties? The Conservative Party and the Alliance Reform Party have decided to get together. It's a pretty major step. They've decided to form a new party rather than form a coalition.
I think they're convinced that forming a coalition between parties at election time in our kind of system is just too difficult. There were certainly a lot of people in the Conservative Party, and even parts of the Alliance, arguing they ought to do that. And that would involve, though, making a decision on a riding-by-riding basis that we'll run here and you won't, and then you'll run there and we won't, making these kind of trade-offs, because they're convinced that the only way... They had to have a combined force. They had to have a merged force of voters to beat the Liberals in an election. That's their theory. A coalition would have required them to make 301 separate deals, one for each. Well, 308. We're going to have 308 ridings in the next election if Parliament passes the redistribution. They would have had to make 308 separate individual deals. And I think they thought that wouldn't be stable. It would be very difficult to enforce. And it's just easier to make one overall one and get it done with. Because what if you only got 108 of the 308 done? Then you would have a kind of chaos. So that's the kind of decision they've made on that. That they believe that in the longer term, if they're going to survive in a plurality system, they would have to merge. That in a different kind of electoral system where they had about the same number of seats as they had votes, they might have formed a coalition government. If the Conservatives had 50 seats and the Alliance had added 100 seats, they could have formed a coalition because they would have had more than any other. That coalition could have had more than any other party, but they couldn't find a way to do it on a district by district basis. That's extremely difficult in a country as big and diverse as Canada. But I'm not privy to any of these people's decision making, so I'm just. Yes, Wendy.
You've said a lot of times that the people who voted but didn't vote for the winning candidate, that their vote is wasted. And I have a really hard time accepting that the vote is wasted. After all, the other person you voted for might have won, and then your vote wouldn't have been wasted. So you still were significantly contributing to the electoral process.
Yes, it's a difficult notion I have a lot of trouble with, too, and I raise it because a lot of people want to think in those terms and want to say it's wasted in the sense that it doesn't contribute to the direct election of a particular individual in the way that a second preference does. But obviously, if you have a race, there's only one person running. It's not a contest. It's not a race. So that everybody who participates in it contributes to the ultimate outcome. So it's a kind of specialized notion of being wasted. It's really, wasted is not a good word. It's a better phrase would be, it doesn't contribute to deciding amongst all the candidates which one will win in the way that most other systems would allow. If you can give a preference, then if your candidate doesn't get elected, your preference will then enter in a subsequent stage and help decide. And I think you're probably right. Wasted is not a great phrase, and I've never thought a lot of it. But a lot of people do believe and think about their vote as sort of wasted because it can't contribute. And that leads to the logic, well, if my vote can't contribute, maybe I shouldn't bother voting because it's just going to be wasted. So there is in the psychology of the population kind of sense of that. Alan, and then maybe we'll have coffee because otherwise people will get grumpy.
What do we do with 50% turnout with the 50% that don't vote? My thinking is that they voted with the majority. Not to decide is to decide.
Well, you could argue that kind of not voting is a kind of decision, and of course it is. But electoral systems don't provide for; they just ignore that, right? You could build into an electoral system a provision that unless a certain percentage of people turned out, it didn't count, and you have to go do it again. But then if no one ever turned out, you could never get it. You know, that's the kind of perennial problem of student politics. You know, most student associations have a kind of quorum that you've got to have 25% show up to change the student constitution. Well, they never get 25% turning out, so they can never change their constitution. So they're, which is either a good or a bad thing, I can never. I don't know of any system that does that. You're perfectly right. There's no logical reason why you couldn't build that into an electoral process. It would be probably more efficient to make voting compulsory if you thought people should vote, and then just let them spoil their ballot, because then you wouldn't risk at least having to do it over and over and over again. Okay, why don't we have coffee and then see you in your group. Thanks.